Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight, we're talking about why your digital privacy matters and what you can do to protect it. Now, like most people, you probably don't think you have anything to hide, so why all the fuss about protecting your footprint online? Well, it's because anyone who uses the internet to shop, socialize, or even read the news is giving away information about themselves, and not just your name, address, and credit card number. What if health insurance companies recorded how often you ate fast food, or dating websites tracked your one-night stands? California is once again on the cutting edge of this issue, passing the most comprehensive privacy law in the country last year, the California Consumer Privacy Act. But lawmakers and lobbyists are now gearing up to change the law, submitting over 20 proposed amendments before the law goes into effect next year. Joining us in the studio tonight to explore the topic of digital privacy is Cooper Quinton, Senior Staff Technologist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, also known as EFF, where he holds security trainings for activists, nonprofit workers, and ordinary folks around the world. Welcome, Cooper.
Hello.
And also joining us here in the studio is Rick Arney, board member of Californians for Consumer Privacy and co-author of the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018. Welcome, Rick.
Good evening.
And we, of course, invite you, our listeners, to join this conversation, and we'll open the phone lines up in just about 20 minutes. The number to dial in is toll-free. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or follow us on Twitter at cityvisions@kalw. So, Rick, let me start with you. Why is digital privacy so important, and why should we be concerned whether our digital privacy is actually protected?
It's important because the amount of information that companies have collected on individuals in the last, say, 5 years is absolutely extraordinary and is being used in ways that people simply have not anticipated. I draw a line towards things like digital discrimination, the ability of an insurance company or a bank or any other company for that matter, to discriminate against people without them even knowing about it with provision of, say, a loan, insurance, employment, medical care. All of these things corporations can make very important decisions on and do it in ways that people didn't anticipate in potentially in discriminatory ways. That's one way. The other way is political manipulation. I mean, clearly we've seen with Cambridge Analytica the ability to change minds by focusing ads so in such a tailored way that it could arguably be described as manipulation, and it's a threat to our democracy, frankly.
So it's beyond just getting more ads that are pitched to you based on where you go. This is about politics. This is about potentially the price you're paying. And is it true that some companies might actually charge you different amounts depending on your digital footprint online for certain products?
Absolutely. There's a lot of evidence that a lot of companies are determining how much to charge you based on how close you live to a store, what your previous habits were, how much money you make. It's quite extraordinary what's going on, and a lot of this is being done in the background. And that's why we actually authored the CCPA of 2018 to give consumers the power to understand that that's going on, find out what information people have collected on them, and order companies to stop selling that information.
And that's the CCPA. It's the California Consumer Privacy Act, and I definitely have a bunch of questions for you about that. But I think for listeners who maybe think, as I said in the opening here, maybe I don't have anything to hide, if it gets down to things like your wallet and your political preferences, I think that starts to open up how many people might care about this. And Cooper Quinton, let me ask you a similar question. You work at EFF. It's been around for about 30 years with the express mission of helping people protect their privacy. So is this the problem or one of the problems that your organization is trying to solve? And how do you respond to people who ask why they should care about digital privacy?
This is certainly a big problem and definitely one of the problems that EFF was founded to resolve. EFF was founded to protect your rights online, and this includes the right to freedom of speech, the right and the right to privacy. And people should care about this because we all do have something to hide. As was stated earlier, you may not want to be influenced. You may not want to have your opinions influenced by companies like Cambridge Analytica. You may not want to have your purchases tracked and used to change prices. You may not want to have your very personal, very private data, such as your sexual preferences, your medical history, who you're dating, online for anyone to buy or steal, such as hackers, other companies, insurance companies, criminals, spies, etc.
And you were mentioning, well, Rick, you were mentioning the political issues, and Cooper, you were backing that up as well in terms of having your data sold to different political entities. And we've all heard about the scandal with Cambridge Analytica, where a private database containing information on about 50 million Facebook users was provided to a voter profiling company, Cambridge Analytica, which then used it to make 30 million psychographic profiles about voters, which it shared during the 2016 election with the Trump campaign, and make targeted political ads. This also came up during the Brexit campaign. So these kinds of privacy breaches can definitely have a serious effect on democracies. And my question for both of you, and Rick, let me start with you, is do you expect similar scandals to hit us around the 2020 election coming up next year?
Absolutely. And here's why. Let me give an example. If you're running for office and say you're a pro-law enforcement candidate, that's sort of your positioning. You think that's going to let you win. Imagine if you could tweak the news feed of everyone in your district so that they receive just slightly more news feed about crime stories in the district. Now, they're now going to be more inclined to vote for you because they think there's more crime in the district, when in fact the reality of that might be utterly different. This is all done because the information that's given to these companies allows them to absolutely micro-target down to what people are most fearful of or what they most want. And again, this is done without a connection perhaps to even reality. And that's why it's threatening, is because we've given all of our information up to companies that can then use it to actually potentially change the outcome of elections.
And Cooper, I want to ask you the same question about whether or not you think this is going to be hitting us in 2020. But I also wanted to ask you about Facebook's new policy that they announced last Wednesday about a privacy vision, where they're going to be now suggesting that future growth is more going to be based on private messaging. So I'm definitely interested in your 2020 election forecast, so to speak, in terms of hacking, but also if you think some of the efforts like Facebook's recent privacy policy might help address this.
So I'm less concerned about hacking in the 2020 election than just about election influence efforts in general by campaigns, by PACs, and by foreign actors. You could, for example, take out, if you were a politician, take out pro-gun ads to constituents in your area that were pro-gun, and anti-gun ads to constituents in your area that were anti-gun, and corner the market that way. Or if you were a unscrupulous actor, you could take out ads that were made a candidate that you didn't like look soft on crime to people who leaned more Republican or leaned more tough on crime. I think that these platforms, such as Facebook, Google, and other ad platforms, allow these sorts of hard-to-trace influence campaigns to really create really insidious propaganda to influence people's decisions. And I'm much more concerned about that. Things like election hacking, of course, are a big concern as well. But those are going to be far easier to detect, and those are far more outside of the norm of what would happen than these sort of ad campaigns that are very much within the norm and very much within the business model of these companies.
And obviously this is a serious problem, and we have issues that we want to talk about here in California. But this, what you're describing here, both of you, in terms of political influence campaigns based on our data, seems like something that requires a federal response. So, Rick, I wanted to ask you if you would recommend any particular federal policy? I mean, what should be the policy response to this idea that we're vulnerable to this kind of influence campaign?
Yeah, so I'm not totally convinced there needs to be per se a federal response. The California Privacy Protection Act of 2018 is probably the strongest privacy protection law in the world right now. And it's our view that if the federal government is going to act on this topic, they should consider the CCPA as the floor, not the ceiling. There's still work to be done. The CCPA is a very strong law, allows you to give power back to consumers to figure out what information has been collected on them, allows them to say no to selling it, and increases fines and penalties for those companies that haven't protected their information. We think at a minimum that should be the base. And if the federal government is going to act, they should not eviscerate anything that has been done in California here. In fact, it should be considered the standard, as a lot of initiatives and laws in California have been. They've spread across the country and then been picked up by Congress later. And that's our hope, frankly.
Well, let's try to dive in a little bit on the California Consumer Privacy Act that you mentioned. And I'm wondering if you can describe for listeners a little bit about the background, how it came about, and some of the provisions beyond what you just described here.
So it came about because a friend of mine, Alistair McTaggart, and I were having drinks one day in the East Bay, thinking about problems out there, and I had been a victim of identity theft. And we started digging into it and realized that this is utterly out of control, the amount of information and the things that can be done with that information. Let me give an example. We found out that we could buy a list of rape victims in California from a data broker, or a list of those that go to domestic violence centers. It's totally out of control that you're able to buy these types of lists and then use them against people. That got us fired up. And so what we did is we spent about a year drafting the law. We hit the road and we qualified an initiative. We collected over 700,000 signatures in California. And then we approached the legislature and, you know, we pulled this thing. We did focus groups. Guess what? It pulled at 81%. Super bipartisan. And the good news is the legislature looked at that and said, do we want this on the ballot where it's going to pass, even though Facebook and Google and Comcast threatened to spend $100 million to bury us? They jumped and they passed it unanimously in the Assembly and Senate of California, and Jerry Brown signed it. And so we think this, you know, privacy is really important. It's good business, is going to be good business going forward. And we think that people should just be more aware, and this law is going to be give people power to understand what's going on with their information.
And when you say good business, you mean actually good for businesses' bottom lines?
I think it will be. I think those companies that embrace privacy are the ones that are going to succeed. Those that disrespect people's privacy, Facebook being the leader in this area, you can see they've lost tens of billions of dollars in market cap. To be clear, I'm a business person, and so is my friend Alistair. We're not some crazies trying to tear down companies. There were people that came to us and wanted to do that. We're not about that. We just want this to be reasonably regulated so that people are better aware and better able to control their information.
And you mentioned that it started as a ballot initiative with 81% yep. support. So what made you want to back off from that and go with legislation, which is much more ripe for being amended yep. and manipulated behind closed doors?
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. There's a trade-off there. There's no doubt. We feel comfortable in light of the position that the populace has taken on this topic that we don't think the legislature is going to undermine it. In fact, there's proposals right now to go beyond that. But it is a trade-off. When you do an initiative, a lot of people in California don't know, you're taking the jurisdiction of that topic away from the legislature. We didn't do that knowing that we got actually more than we bargained for in the legislature. So we think it's popular enough to remain. There will be attempts always to fight it. But every day that goes by, you see more hacking and more problems from these companies. That's simply free advertising for more privacy.
And can you describe some of the key elements that's in the legislation that really made you comfortable dropping the ballot yep. initiative because you secured it legislatively?
Yeah. So the main elements that we were able to preserve, in fact, we got pretty much everything that was in the initiative except for a few items. What this allows you to do is request of a company, what information have you collected on me? And they have to tell you what they have and where they've sold it. You then can tell them, don't sell it anymore. And furthermore, because of all the hacking that goes on, it used to be when a company got hacked and their information was stolen, in order for you to get any redress on that, you had to prove who stole the information, where it went, how it was used, and what your damages were. Well, we all know that might be in the Ukraine. It's sold to some guy in Florida who then used it against you. Now, under this law, the hacking itself becomes the problem. That is the act at which now the companies are going to have to pay if they didn't secure your information. And we think that's appropriate. When we got that, we were excited about it and moved forward.
And what was the opposition like? Because I imagine the tech companies weren't very happy about this. So what were some of your interactions there? And why did they ultimately – it sounds like they at least came around to support this legislation. What do you think was their thinking?
Yeah, I would say they marginally supported it. I think a lot of the tech companies were in denial about this. I mean, let's be clear. These tech companies have had years of an absolute free-for-all of getting the information for free and then using it to monetize to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. They told us, we're going to spend $100 million to bury you, and we knew that was like a down payment. I don't have that kind of money, nor do any of my friends. But you know what? The idea carried the day, and with 700,000 Californians signing a petition for it, they didn't have much of a candle to carry in the legislature at that point.
And are you concerned that there may be federal law that could preempt what you're doing here in the state level?
There is always that concern. The federal government could step in and say, we're going to take control of this, and we're going to preempt California, which means it would eviscerate what we've done in California. Right now, I don't think the probability of that is very high, primarily because Think about this. The CCPA was voted on unanimously by almost every legislator in the Assembly and Senate that was available that day. Every Republican and every Democrat, no one voted no on it. And when legislators see, you know, the polling on this, and a lot of people don't like polls, but when something polls at 81%, the only poll I've seen in my time in politics that is higher is the poll to ban human trafficking, which polled about 91%. So we're up in that number. And so with that type of popularity, it's hard to see politicians stepping over that saying we're going to push back on it.
And I don't think we want to know who are the 9% who seem to be in favor of human trafficking, for that matter.
Yeah, that's a real problem.
And I have to ask one other question on this, on California law that you helped get passed. So was it modeled on Europe's general data protection regulation, which is a similar kind of effort? And, you know, and don't most of these companies already have to comply with that European law anyway, so how much is the California law going to be going beyond what the European law is?
Yeah, the GDPR is an interesting law that was passed in the European region, and it does accomplish a lot of the same things that CCPA does. I would say some of the penalties are a little more punitive in the GDPR. Also, I think that it's in some cases a little more corporate focused. I think we've struck the right balance here of giving power back to consumers and letting the consumer access their information directly. And I think that's a distinguishing point with the CCPA.
And Cooper, wanted to bring you back into this discussion. I appreciate you standing by on this kind of deep dive on the California Consumer Privacy Act. Wanted to follow up with you, first of all, on that Facebook question. What do you see private entities like Facebook doing? Is there any reason we can have some hope that they're going to be taking some steps on their own, perhaps in response to this market pressure that they're now facing with all these scandals?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the market pressure is actually pretty serious. You've seen companies like Apple really succeeding on a platform of privacy for their users, and you've seen companies, startups like DuckDuckGo, also really succeeding on a platform of privacy for their users. And I think we're going to see that more and more. I think that Facebook sees the writing on the wall, and that's what has prompted Zuckerberg's latest proclamations that Facebook is going to become a privacy company. I think that that's great. I think that companies are seeing that people want privacy, and I think that people are waking up to what's being done with the data that they're giving these companies for free, that they're actually paying for these services, which are otherwise monetarily free, with their most personal and private data, with their thoughts, with what they're reading, and with the ability to potentially influence their actions. And I think that that's very concerning to many people once they realize that that's the case.
And so, you know, beyond what private companies are going to be doing, what kinds of policy responses, Cooper, would you like to see? I mean, we've heard about the California Consumer Privacy Act. I mean, do you feel like that's enough, or do you think more needs to be done?
Yeah, so I think that the California Consumer Privacy Act is a fantastic starting place, and I'm really glad that we got that legislation in. I think as was said, it's the strongest that we have right now, and I think it's a fantastic start. EFF, along with ACLU California and a few other organizations, have been pushing a bill called in the California Assembly called AB 1760, which we're calling by the catchier name Privacy for All. And this would be a set of amendments to the CCPA to make it even stronger. So the three main tenets here are power for all, which means that a company has to get your permission to share and use personal information, not just to collect it and not just to sell it. Knowledge for all, a company has to tell a Californian what personal information it has collected and shared about you if you ask for it. And rights for all, which means that a company can't punish you with higher prices or degraded service if you ask for what the private information it has collected about you. We're pushing that bill just to strengthen the CCPA and make it even better.
And so that bill, AB 1760, is sponsored or authored by Assemblymember Buffy Wicks, just across the bay here over in Oakland. So definitely happy to have some Bay Area representation in our legislature carrying on with this issue. And this is one of these new legislative responses in the wake of the California Consumer Privacy Act passing last year. And how do you think, Cooper, I'll start with you, how do you think companies are going to be responding to AB 1760 if it passes, like particularly a company like Facebook?
In what sense?
Well, so you think about Facebook, which extends to those companies that share data in
right.
addition to those that sell it. So do you think that Facebook is going to change their practices at all in response?
If this passed, I think that Facebook would have to mm-hmm. change their practices. I think that they'd be forced to. And ideally, companies would change their practices across the board to allow these sorts of things rather than just change their practices for Californians and keep the same shady practices for everybody else that's not covered under the CCPA.
So as goes California, so will go the rest of the world just by default, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah, California sets the standard. All right, well, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about how you can protect your digital privacy, and we're joined by Cooper Quinton, Senior Staff Technologist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, also known as EFF, where he holds security trainings for activists, nonprofit workers, and ordinary folks around the world. And we're also joined by Rick Arney, board member of Californians for Consumer Privacy and co-author of the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018. We'd love to hear from you on this issue. Our phone lines are open. What concerns do you have about protecting your personal information online? Has your digital privacy ever been compromised? And what tools do you use to protect your online privacy? So call in with your questions or comments. The number to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on kalw.org or follow us on Twitter at City Visions KALW. So we have a caller, David, from the East Bay. So, David, welcome to City Visions.
Hello?
Hi, David. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Welcome to City Visions. What's your question for the, for the panelists?
My question has to do with the phenomenon that's becoming more prevalent where retailers advertise sale prices. But they make those sale prices available only to people who are so-called club card holders. I'm speaking specifically of grocery chains and drugstore and pharmacy chains. And recently I had an interaction with, I'm gonna name the company, it's CVS, and I have told them that I refuse to allow my personal information to be tracked. And that I demand that my personal privacy be protected. And up till very recently, they have been willing to give me the advertised sale price on an item, even though I am not a so-called card holder. Recently, they have changed their policy on a corporate level, and they refuse to offer the sale price to people who do not allow their personal information to be collected. And I'm wondering if any of the legislation that's already been passed or is contemplated in the future will address this particular issue.
All right. Well, we've got someone here who can speak directly to that question about legislative action. So let me start at least first with Rick Arney. You want to respond to David's question?
Yeah, David, that's a terrific question, and you've hit upon something really important. That is the idea of, can a company essentially discriminate against you if you don't give them the information they're asking for? Under the CCPA, which, by the way, is effective coming 2020, that type of behavior will not be allowed, in the sense that they're not going to be able to say, we're not going to service you if you don't give the information. They will, however, be able to say, okay, if you're not going to give us information, this may cost you slightly more, but not in a coercive way. The dollar amount that they could charge you to do this will not exceed the value that they get from having that information. But you've hit upon something really important, and that is your information is worth something to them. And you've really got at that by looking at this and saying, hey, I'm just not going to give this up. I'm going to demand some power back in order to make sure that, you know, you're not just making money off of my personal data.
Yeah,
Cooper, yeah, why don't you weigh in as well on some of the specifics of David's question?
Yeah, certainly. The trend toward these loyalty card programs has been pretty concerning, and it touches on something that I wanted to mention earlier, which is that the sort of obvious effects of this, like what you get from Google and Facebook, are only the tip of the iceberg as far as this private data collection. And really, the rest of the iceberg is comprised of these companies called data brokers, which are taking all of this data that you're putting out into the world every day, often without even realizing it, from what you purchase on your credit card, what you purchase with loyalty cards, what you do online that's tracked by people other than Google and Facebook. And this is all compiled into these databases where you get lists like the ones that Rick was talking about, the list of people who are rape victims or the list of women in domestic violence shelters, right? All of this data is sitting in databases with companies that you've never even heard of. And you oftentimes have, you know, never consented to give these companies your data. You certainly haven't consented for them to sell it or put you on lists like the ones Rick mentioned, but those lists are out there. And one of the big ways that data feeds into these are through things like these loyalty card programs. So yeah, they're very insidious. If you were to go to the store and they were to tell you, we'll pay you $5 if you let us track everything you buy at this store for the rest of time and also give us your name, age, your marital status, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, you'll save $5. You might make that calculus very differently about whether you would make that transaction.
All right. So something for listeners to think about. And hopefully, David, that answers your question. Thanks so much for dialing in. Let's go back to the phones. We have Ariane calling in. Ariane, welcome to City Visions.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I want to alert people to the fact that these companies, tech companies, are not only monitoring our shopping acts and interests, and also what we buy locally and what our interests are in terms of politics, but they're actually censoring information, which is a form of book burning in a way, like the Nazis did. I can say that I spent a decade of my life researching massive incarceration. I wrote 3 books for my dissertation in graduate school about Jim Crow and the criminalization of indigent mentally ill people of color. And I gave up the copyright, and Google blocked every link that could possibly be found to my dissertation for the first 10 years.
All right, so Ariane, it's an interesting question around censorship, and I think Cooper can probably best respond to that. So Cooper, what do you have to say to Ariane in the situation about deleting and censorship of data?
Yeah, certainly. So the First Amendment is a pretty important tenet in American politics, which applies to government, but doesn't, unfortunately, apply to – or, well, fortunately or unfortunately, for better or worse, does not apply to private companies and private entities such as you or myself. However, there's a question of whether the First Amendment should apply to companies, to the things that you say on these public platforms like Facebook, like Twitter, like Google. And it's a big question that's hard to answer right now, but we see the effects of it, right? If you don't censor hate speech, then hate speech can grow on these platforms. But on the other hand, who's to say, you know, one person's hate speech might be another person's free speech, right? It's hard to judge that line. And companies have addressed this by hiring people to moderate their platforms en masse. And that moderation has historically not gone very well. You've ended up censoring things that all of civil society agrees should not be censored. So it's a hard question. It's hard to say, but definitely we need to change the way that things are censored or not censored right now. It's certainly not working.
And it's tough when you have private companies rather than the government and how to,
exactly,
how to draw that line. So thank you, Ariane, for calling in with that
issue.
Can
I interject?
Sure. If you have a quick comment, because we have other listeners.
I just want to comment. So actually, Google's working with the NSA, and what I was writing about was against racism and was promoting social justice, and I beg to differ. When they're controlling the flow of information and obliterating dialogue that would promote people thinking critically about the status quo, I don't think it's just benign. They're actually working with aspects or parts of the government that are actually threatening all life on the planet.
Ariane, we appreciate that you bring this issue to our attention. We do hope you also post whatever you'd like to post, any material on our website as well. But we definitely appreciate you dialing in to City Visions. I want to just go to an email question. A listener from Marin asks, and this is a question for you, Rick, if you can speak to the practical application of this new California law that we've been talking about, the California Consumer Privacy Act, and what it will mean for California California incorporated companies or California residents? So I think it's a sort of question around, you know, incorporation here or out of state.
Yeah, where it applies. It's a good question. So the way that we wrote the CCPA, it actually applies to any company that does business with a California resident. So it doesn't have to be a company that's incorporated in California. And that's where a lot of the power of this law comes in, because we have 40 million people here. So if you are a company in New York and you're doing business with the California consumer, you fall under the CCPA. And what that means is if a California resident says, tell me what they have on you, you have to provide that. And if a California resident says, please stop selling it, you have to do that. And if you don't, there'll be penalties that accrue from that.
All right. Well, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking about how you can protect your digital privacy. And we're joined by Cooper Quinton from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF. And we're also joined by Rick Arney, board member of California's for Consumer Privacy and co-author of the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018. We want to hear from you, your questions or comments. A number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at CityVisionsKALW. We're going to go to the phones once again. We have Ruth Ann calling in from El Cerrito. Ruth Ann, welcome back to City Visions.
Yeah, good evening. I wanted to ask the people who are responsible for drafting the law, isn't it such that consumers have to actively opt in to have it take effect, as opposed to it just taking effect automatically? And if you didn't care if they did something with your data, you could opt out.
All right. So Rick Arney is one of the law's principal sponsors.
Yeah, Ruthanne, that's a great question. There is, in the parlance of privacy, there's the topic of opt-in versus opt-out. And what we made the choice to do in this situation, because we felt like it was the most constitutionally protected way to proceed, would be that a consumer would have to actively tell a company, please stop selling their information. The alternative would be a company would have to get your permission before they start selling it. It was our belief on our team that taking the latter approach would most likely not meet constitutional muster. We wanted to build a law that was for the generations. It wouldn't get eviscerated by the courts. So we made that choice. There are those that differ, though. And some of the laws that are pending, or some of the bills that are pending in the legislature, do go that route. And it remains to be seen if that is going to be supported by the legislature and the governor and eventually supported by the courts. But that was the thinking we brought to it, is we wanted to be as practical as possible and get something that would actually hopefully stand the test of time.
All right. Well, thank you, Ruth Ann, for that question. And another phone call from Karen in Berkeley. Karen, welcome to City Visions. Are you there, Karen?
So, you know that bracelet that people wear that shows you their blood pressure? I forgot what it's called. It monitors your heartbeat. It tells you how many steps.
The Fitbit. I think you're talking about a Fitbit, right?
Yeah.
Of the what?
A Fitbit. The bracelet, the Fitbit.
Fitbit. Okay, so this is the thing about the Fitbit. So this gentleman that had the Fitbit, he had a diabetes or had something, and it was monitoring his blood sugar and his blood pressure and his heart rate and everything. And so he wanted to get some medication, and his insurance company said that he wasn't going to be allowed because the Fitbit had sent him back tracking information about how many steps he took or what he ate or his heart rate. And so since they had been alerted, the insurance company had been alerted by the transmission from the Fitbit, they had disallowed him to get what he needed because of that electronic transmission. And one other thing, the head of the FBI, I believe, stated in the last few months, if 20 years ago he had said that every home in America would install a listening device, there would have been a huge outcry. Now people could just go buy Alexa or Echo Dot on Amazon, and that's what they've got.
All right. So thank you for that, Karen. I appreciate it. Cooper, Quinton, do you want to respond to Karen?
Yeah, thank you for your comments, Karen. This is an excellent illustration of the problem right now, which is that companies have realized that the big new product for them is your personal data, and that they can harvest your personal data and use that as their raw product that they are now selling to other companies. Even a company like Fitbit, which on the surface might look like a company that is selling you a good in exchange for money, is doing that, but also primarily taking your data from that Fitbit and selling it to other companies such as insurance providers in exchange for their money. And that's now the raw, you are the raw material that companies are buying and selling.
So in ways we wouldn't even expect when we buy a product like Fitbit. So Rick Arney, did you want to weigh in on this as well?
The really interesting thing about Fitbit, thanks Cooper, on that one is that if you gave your heart rate to a doctor, that doctor, if he sells that in, he or she sells that information or gives it to somebody else, is breaking federal law. Fitbit, not a doctor, not a medical device. They can take that information and sell it however they want. And this is what consumers don't know. It's a huge loophole. Your heart rate, what you do, where you walk, how your health is, that's sellable with that type of device, which doesn't fall under HIPAA, which a normal doctor would get into a lot of trouble selling or sharing. This is the kind of stuff that when people wake up to and realize, wow, think how I could price insurance or exclude people from the insurance market if I knew what their day-to-day health is. It's really scary.
So, Rick, I mean, should we make this illegal?
Well, we should start certainly by controlling it, and consumers now will have that ability with Fitbit to say, hey, what are you collecting on me? And if you're collecting it, don't sell it.
So, all right, Karen, thank you so much for bringing the Fitbit issue to our attention with that question. We appreciate the phone call. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have Pam calling in from Orinda. Pam, welcome to City Visions. What's your question for the panelists?
Hi, thanks. This is a two-part question. First, to Rick, how do you get the information about how the websites are using your information? And two, does the law have any provision for a central site where you can go and register your, your email address, kind of like the do not call list or something, to prevent the sites from using your information?
Great question, Pam. So how will you be able to get the info? I'll answer that one first. Come 2020, companies will be required to provide you information on how you can make a request to them to actually find out what information they have on you. Now, here's the great thing that we put into the law, which I thought was really exciting, is we allowed third parties to do this on your behalf. So it's our anticipation, and a lot of companies have approached me to talk about their new offerings or potential offerings. You will be able to in 2020 to ask another company to say, hey, do this all for me. Go collect out from all these companies what information they've been collecting on me. Now, you've asked a great question. Should there be a do not call list? And we actually looked at that very closely when we were writing the law because, by the way, do not call is like super popular. People love that program. The problem we had with including something like a do not call infrastructure out there is that we did not feel comfortable having a central repository of everyone's data. Because I think Cooper could comment on this, eventually that would get hacked. And you can imagine the master file on every Homo sapien in California. It would be quite terrifying if that was hacked into. So rather than go that route and actually have a law that has unintended consequences where a grand database is created with everything, we thought, okay, let's let people access that data, which you'll be able to do in the CCPA, and you'll actually be able to use a separate company to do that on your behalf to streamline it so you don't have to do all the paperwork.
All right. So thank you, Pam and Arinda, for that question. We appreciate it. Also have an email in from Nikki, who asks a pretty specific question. She asks, should I have ditched Yahoo when it became part of Oath? She says she very reluctantly okayed switching over to Oath to keep her Yahoo email account, since she couldn't imagine moving 20 years of email. But she says it's a scary policy because Oath, quote, analyzes and stores all communications content, including email content from incoming and outgoing mail and attachments. So I think this is a really critical email question, especially for those using Gmail, for example, very popular. Are these companies reading our emails? What are they doing with that information? Cooper, do you want to respond to that concern?
Yeah, certainly. This is a really hard trade-off, right? When you have As the emailer said, 20 years of mail stored with this company. How are you going to ever move that over to a new email address? And you have all your accounts hooked up to this email address. You have, you know, all of your contacts. Everybody who ever wants to contact you is going to have that email address, right? Once you're locked into some of these companies like Facebook, Google, Yahoo, it can be really hard to get out of them. And you kind of just have to, you know, they put you in a position where you have to accept whatever privacy or lack of privacy policy or surveillance policy they want to throw at you, which is one of the reasons why we're really happy about CCPA and future strengthenings of it, because you are so locked into working with these companies.
Is there anything people can do to protect themselves with these email companies?
There are some things you can do. Yes, one is to, you know, gradually switch over to a email provider that will protect your privacy more. And I don't want to recommend make any specific recommendations here, but you can do research. You can look on EFF Surveillance Self Defense Guide, which is at ssd.eff.org, and we have tutorials there on how to make more privacy preserving email addresses. You can gradually switch over to that and let your contacts know and keep both email addresses going for a while you switch over. You can do things like, if you want to get really advanced, you can do things like encrypt your email, although that can be extremely difficult and error prone. But that will certainly prevent the company hosting your email from being able to read it.
All right. So some options there if people are truly motivated outside of policy responses. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're talking about how you can protect your digital privacy. We're joined by Cooper Quinton, Senior Staff Technologist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF. And we're also joined by Rick Arney, Board Member of Californians for Consumer Privacy and co-author of the California Consumer Privacy Act of 2018. We want to hear from you. Please keep calling in with your questions or comments. That number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on kalw.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Let's go to another listener calling in with a question. We have Colleen from San Francisco. Colleen, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling because my daughter recently applied to college, and the College Board holds so much. It has all of the test scores, but also the financial aid is processed through their system. And I just received an email from a college she applied to that her data has been compromised. And, you know, it's really hard when, you know, a family applying for financial aid doesn't really have a choice about using a system like that. And now I feel like I have a 17-year-old who their system was hacked, and the letter said that happened at other universities as well.
All right, so important issue there about hacking and your financial data, colleges. So let's see. I'll start with Rick, if you want to respond to him.
Yeah, sorry to hear that happen. You know, hearing that your data has been breached is no fun because you don't know what's going to happen after that. One suggestion I'd have for you is a kind of cool California law that happened quite some time ago allows you to freeze your credit report and that of your children. And what that does is really exciting, and I've frozen my credit, and I'm sure Cooper probably has too. It allows you to freeze your credit report so that anybody who makes an inquiry to grant credit on your behalf, it will be denied because they can't get your credit reports. When you go to the bank and apply for a mortgage, they're going to pull a credit report. And when they go to pull that report and it can't be pulled because your report is frozen, then a fraudulent mortgage can't be taken out in your name. Now, it's really easy to use because you have a 1-800 number where you can unfreeze it for a day or 30 days, let the bank go in, take a look at it, and then freeze it back. I think that's a great way to protect yourself in the case where you know your financial information has been stolen, to prevent people from taking, say, your Social Security number, your address, and going out and trying to open a credit card in your name. They won't be able to do it if your credit report is frozen. So that'd be one suggestion
for
you.
All right, some good advice
there.
Step
up from the fraud alert.
Yeah, fraud. I'm not a huge fan of fraud alert because to me that's like telling you, hey, this just happened. You know, now there's a real problem. The credit freezing the credit report prevents the problem from happening. I don't quite understand the fraud alert. It's just sort of like, hey, you just got screwed. Now it's your problem. I'd rather prevent that from happening, and that's why I like the credit.
So you
freeze.
Do the yeah. Okay.
And
I have one.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I wanted to let Cooper also respond to you as well, Colleen.
Oh, great. Okay.
Or actually, if you want to go ahead, Colleen, go ahead. Cooper's saying you should ask.
No,
her,
have one related comment because my daughter is a senior in high school, and I teach media literacy in elementary schools. And I feel like there's a generation, like younger kids are now getting a lot of information about protecting their data. But I try to talk about it, and I've taught this with my daughter, and it seems like there was a window where the kids didn't learn it, and it's really hard to talk to them about it because they didn't, they came later, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Like, my daughter's a senior in high school, and she went through school before all the digital citizenship curriculum came out. So I'm worried about that bandwidth of kids who just don't see it as a problem at all.
Well, sure, sort of an education gap here. Cooper, I know you lead trainings on security systems. Cooper, do you want to respond?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for your call. There's a few things I want to respond to here, but I'll start with the digital citizenship question. Yeah, there's definitely, I think that our whole society is still grappling with and trying to learn how to navigate this, you know, sea change in technology and in how we interact with the world and the digital world that's happened in the last decade or two. I think it's there are, you know, several generations, including probably, you know, my own generation and your own generation, that grew up without any of this training, and we've had to learn it on our own. And I'm not any less confident that the kids in your daughter's generation will be any less able to learn it than we are, or, you know, than you are or than I am. That said, I do think it's really great that schools are starting to do this. I think that it's important to treat this like we treated anything, like home ec or sex education, and really teaching kids how to interact with the digital world, I think, is so important. The other thing I wanted to talk about, and I'm so sorry that your information got stolen, and the unfortunate fact is now that almost everybody that's online has at this point been the victim of a data breach to one degree or another. Some of those are only emails and passwords. Some, like yours, are, you know, much more potentially affecting, right? So, for example, that there was a data breach of Equifax, which is one of the major credit companies, and they, you know, people lost their social security numbers, a lot of their personal private financial information. And that's the result of the fact that so many of these companies are hoarding all of our information in these databases, as much information as they can find about us in these databases. And those databases are 100% of the time vulnerable to being breached and being stolen. I absolutely agree with Rick about freezing your credit. I think that's probably the best thing you can do at this point. But
what else can be done? I mean, we have these big treasure troves of data just sitting out there, you know, ripe for the hacking, as you describe it. What should be done?
Right. So, unfortunately, there's not much else that individual consumers can do. However, things like the CCPA will certainly help. And, you know, increasing market pressure on these companies to stop hoarding these troves of data is always a big step in the right direction.
Yeah, the Experian breach that Cooper referred to, under the CCPA, that would have cost them hundreds of millions of dollars, and rightfully so, because you know what happened there? Those guys had the security patch for their software, and it just sat on their desk for like 3 months, and they didn't implement it. And with that type of negligence, there's going to be a cost to it. And hopefully that's when companies will actually take reasonable steps to secure their information.
Well, let's talk about that, and particularly with the California Consumer Privacy Act, what that now will mean in terms of penalties. We have an email in from Skylar in Ross, who asks what type of penalties are going to apply to those that violate these new laws, and do we have sufficient teeth now to properly change behavior?
Yeah. I think under the CCPA, with respect to data breaches, so the way we wrote this is we wanted to be reasonable, because a lot of these data breaches are simply done by just what I described as gross negligence, not encrypting a database, not putting security patches on. There already is, in existing California law, before the CCPA, guidance on what a company that deals with California consumers should do to protect their data. What we did with CCPA is says, look, if you don't follow the basic tenets of security, then what can happen is you can get sued and the attorney general can step in. And when he or she does, or the consumers do individually, we're talking fines that are accruing – that will accrue by the amount of records and people that were breached. And those numbers are huge. We're talking hundreds of millions multiplied by fines that, depending on the nature of the breach, from $750, if it's intentional, up to $2,500. That's where you start getting some major league fines. And again, to be clear, I'm a business guy. I don't like major league fines, but I do like major league fines in situations where there's really gross malfeasance, and that's what this law is going to take care of.
All right, Cooper.
And these are all just the basic tenets of digital hygiene that we're asking these companies to do. These are the, you know, sort of digital equivalent of washing your hands and taking aspirin, right? Or these are the digital equivalent, more like the digital equivalent of sanitizing the floors at a hospital, right? We're asking companies to take basic steps like not keep data that they don't need for a business purpose, encrypt the data that they are keeping, and do their best to make sure that hackers can't get in.
And along these lines around penalties, we have an email in from Rebecca who asks, who do we call if we find out that we've been the victim of a cybercrime or a privacy breach? And for context, she says, we know that if we've been burglarized, we call the local police department. And if we come across a national crime, we call the FBI. So what about scammers and that kind of breach? So, Rick, do you want to respond to Rebecca?
One of the first calls I'd make is get on the web of the California Attorney General's privacy website. And there you will find the phone numbers and ways to contact the people that are going to be enforcing this. And I can tell you the neat thing is we've worked a lot with these people. They're currently writing the regulations to implement the CCPA, and they are very, very consumer-focused. And they get the joke, so to speak. They want to help, and I think that would be one of the first calls I would make would be the California Attorney General's Office consumer unit that handles privacy enforcement.
All right, some advice there. We have a comment in from a concerned citizen who says, I don't want to spend any more time dealing with my privacy online. I want companies to be responsible and accountable for protecting my privacy in the same way banks protect my investments with FDIC insurance. Saddling the individual with the labor of privacy policing is just another tactic industry and government use to relinquish themselves of their civic duties. So that's a comment from a concerned citizen. I think others might share that view as well. And also want to go to the phone lines again. We have Jamie calling in from San Francisco. So Jamie, welcome to City Visions.
Oh, yes. I was just following up on an earlier call from David who was concerned about some discriminatory practices by CVS for only giving discounts to members who join the club and essentially give away your information. I'm finding more and more businesses now, especially in the Bay Area, are only taking credit cards and not cash. And I have concerns that it's really the real reason is because they want to get your information, your data, and sell it. Does the new law cover anything like that?
Yeah, it does. Depends on how serious you are about your privacy. You can go buy prepaid debit cards, and that's one way to conceal what you're doing. But yes, this law, when you go ahead and use that credit card at a merchant, you will then now be able to tell that merchant, don't sell that information. And by the way, just real quickly, we define sell very broadly. It's not just sell for money. It's sell for any commercial purpose, including any type of relationship that would accrue value from. We wrote that very broadly because we don't want people to use it as a potential loophole. But yes, if you go and use your credit card and information is collected from that, you will be able to tell the merchant that they cannot sell your information if it's a reasonable size merchant.
And Cooper?
Also, I think the city of Philadelphia, I want to say, just recently banned cashless stores. And I think that's a great move. I'd love to see that here as well.
All right. Let's go back to the phone lines. I do want to thank Jamie for that question. But Milana from San Francisco also dialing in. Milana, welcome.
Hi. I'm wondering if the law covers situations where your information has been sold in the past, for example, Verizon, Comcast, et cetera, or is it just from 2020?
All right, great question, Milana. Rick Carney, do you want to respond?
Yeah, that's a great question. It will be effective going forward from 2020. But to be clear, if a company has that information already in their database, they have to tell you they did collect it and have that information on file, and then you can tell them to not sell it and stop selling it from there on. They also, if they have sold it, they have to inform the companies they've sold to that they are under the CCPA.
All right. Thank you for that question. And we'll go back to the phones to Justin here in San Francisco. Justin, welcome.
Yeah, hi. So I had a question regarding companies that have your past information and they try to sell it to take it off, and if they would have the right to do that. But I really want to ask this. Google and Facebook and whatnot have been argued for utilities in the past. And I'm curious that, here's my scenario. They stop being able to use your information to sell it. Advertisers now can't use it and they can't make the same amount of money. Would that prompt them to start charging you to use Facebook and Google and all these places online, which, like I said, is argued to be a utility? Because I remember the North Bay fires. People couldn't use their phone. People couldn't use a lot of accesses, but they could use Facebook to mark they're safe. Mm-hmm. So they're very important in a lot of ways. And I'm curious what angle they'll take if they're pushed and not being able to use the advertising aspect.
So, Rick Arney, you've been dealing with the tech companies on these legislative efforts.
That's a great question, because let's be clear. Some of these technologies are really good. A lot of people like them. They're very popular and they're useful, and they sometimes help people with unsafe situations. So that's clear. When we built CPCPA, we didn't want to get in the way of that, and so we don't want a world where you have to make that kind of choice between having the service of a company and getting charged excessively because you gave up your information. So we did have an anti-discrimination provision in there that would disallow that behavior from happening. The other thing I want to mention, which cuts at what you're saying, also what Milana said in the earlier call, this law allows you to tell a company to remove data they've collected on you that you've given to them. So you have the right to ask them to delete that data too. Mm-hmm. And it's an important part of CCPA that was added at the last minute, which I think is also important.
And Cooper, we only have a couple minutes left, so I want to let you go ahead and respond to Justin. But also just want to ask you as a sort of a final question for listeners, what do you recommend people do to protect their privacy online?
Great. So to respond to Justin's question really quickly, yeah, I think that companies will still be able to exist just fine after this. Magazines and radio stations and TV stations have been existing for years on advertisements that are based on the content of the TV station, not based on the consumer habits of each individual consumer. And I think that websites and social media companies will be able to exist on that. As far as what you can do to protect your privacy online, you can use companies that are invested in protecting your privacy, things like DuckDuckGo for search. You can use EFF has a browser add-on called Privacy Badger that actually blocks the invisible trackers that follow you around online and try to build up databases of what you're looking at online. And you can visit our surveillance self-defense guide at ssd.eff.org for a bunch more tips on how you can protect your privacy and your security online.
And real quick, we have an email question from Caleb who asks if the incognito window function is one of those tips to protect your information and browsing history.
That is potentially one way you can protect your information, although it's not perfect. Actually, the purpose of the incognito window is mainly to keep things out of your history on your browser and not to prevent you from being tracked. So if you want to stop yourself from being tracked, again, things like Privacy Badger or the Tor browser are definitely better bets.
All right, great. And then Rick Arney, just final thoughts. What do you see coming up next on the policy front? What do you think needs to happen as a follow-up to what you helped get passed with the California Consumer Privacy Act?
Yeah, I think people need to assert their rights and really think about where their information is being used. I leave you with a quick story. During the campaign, we needed to get endorsements from groups, and one of the endorsements we wanted to get was from law enforcement. I approached the Oakland Police Department Union and asked them for their endorsement, and the thing that got them fired up and got them to endorse this is I showed them an ad from a data broker that for $25,000, I could buy the home address of every police officer in California. That made them flip out. And so that's one vignette where if consumers realize what's going on here, I ask that people embrace CCPA, use it, ask companies what data that they have on them, assert their rights to tell them to stop selling it. With that level of awareness and activity, we're going to take back power about our information and have the privacy rights that we have been granted under the California Constitution.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests were Cooper Quinton, Senior Staff Technologist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Rick Arney of Californians for Consumer Privacy. Thank you for being here.
Thank you much.
And thank you all listeners for joining in. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper and Jennifer Ruick. Join us next time on City Visions, next Monday night, when we discuss how artificial intelligence may transform the healthcare industry. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week.